Welcome to the Sober Gay Sunday podcast, a podcast about being gay and sober and not just on Sundays. In this podcast, we'll explore the ins and outs of being queer and sober in a world where drinking and using is woven into the fabric of our culture. This season, we'll be hearing the stories of addiction and recovery from sober gays from all over the world. Every story of recovery is unique in its own way, and every story deserves to be heard. So let's go. In this episode, we welcome Dallas. Dallas is from Charlotte, North Carolina. He is a father of two life-saving adults, a sobriety coach for gay men, and an adjunct professor of business. He is also the host of the Aftermath Podcasts, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please welcome Dallas.
Hey, Dallas, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Sorry, I wasn't ready. Yes, thank you for having me.
ready, of course. Yeah. So how's your week going so far?
Well, it's been an interesting week for me. I was preparing for my own podcast, or, you know, hoping to launch one. And in what I wanted to do was interview my family. So my mom, and because what really inspired me to do this was, you know, when my mother, who's a Southern West Virginia lady, found out the first time she found out I was doing any drugs, I was arrested and I had to tell her. Wow. And the worst that she could think of was, are you smoking weed? And so, you know, we had to go from there. But anyway, I wanted to create a repository of tools and resources for families is what I started to do. So okay. I went to sit down with my mom and my sister and my kids and my brother, and we all got together last weekend, and it was not what I expected. And it kind of, you know, anytime you experience something that's a stimulus for growth, it's unexpected. And it was out of the blue. And I figured out that my mom had a total different understanding of what had happened, because I had lied to her the whole time, and she believed me unconditionally, because that's what moms do. And so then I kind of corrected her and told her what had really happened. I saw shock on her face. So anyway, I've been in a topsy-turvy emotional place this week, going back through and realizing, even with my sister, I didn't remember things the way they actually happened. She did. And so it's been an interesting, enlightening week.
That's tough. Yeah. I mean, when I first got sober, it was like 10 years ago, and it was the same thing. I was in trouble with drinking. I had gotten my second DUI. And my parents, of course, knew about that. But then, you know, I kind of slid back into club drugs and then back into crystal meth and had a big relapse back in 2020 in the middle of like the summer. And so my boyfriend and I split, and, you know, my parents loved my boyfriend at the time. And so I told them, and I had said, you know, I had relapsed on drugs, and I had, you know, that had been really the cause of our breakup. But it was also like the middle of the pandemic. And so I don't really think they were like really in the mental place to like really collect what I was dishing out. Mm-hmm. And so then when I was coming up on a year, they were like, wait, what? What do you mean? So they were also just kind of like not really, that the whole storyline was unclear to them. And it was on my mom's birthday. And she was like, we'd really like you to explain to us like your whole story. Because if you're doing this well. And I'm like, on your birthday? Like, we're like dad's grilling burgers. My sister and her husband are like, right there. So I you know, I gave them kind of the watered down version just to, you know, just not to kill the mood, man. But I completely get that. Yeah, right. I completely get that, like the family whole thing. It's just like, and it draws, you know, pulls up a lot of past kind of trauma from being a shithead to them. Like, it sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So I feel that. So why don't you tell us your preferred pronouns and just a little bit about yourself?
He, him, is my preferred pronouns. A little bit about me is, let's see, I have two adult children, so they're first priority for me. And I'm also a sobriety coach now. I also am an adjunct professor at a university. I teach in the business program. And I My favorite thing to do is write. And for some reason lately, well, not lately, but for the past 10 years, I've been avoiding it, but it's just burning inside me to write, 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 write. So that's my passion. That's me in a nutshell.
That's pretty cool. I love that. You live in Charlotte, North Carolina, right?
Live in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeah. And I guess I should mention that I'm sober from crystal meth. August will be 6 years.
Oh, that's amazing. Congratulations. All right. So what you're going to do is you're just going to start us off with like your first drinking and using experience, and then just kind of pull us through your whole story up until where you're at right now.
Sure. So my first using experience was crystal meth, and actually crystal meth was the first drug I ever tried. And I was 39 years old at this time. And so I had come out at 36 and went straight into a relationship. And that fell through pretty quickly. Well, I wouldn't say pretty quickly, but it took almost a year and a half to get through that. I just wouldn't let it go because I'd waited 36 years for that, and I thought this was the answer to my prayers. And anyway, that fell through, and so I was on a blanket in May, in the sun, reading a book. And I just happened to say, I'm going to check Grindr. I don't know. It was like Sunday morning. And I checked Grindr, and there was a new square on the grid. And it was this guy who asked me if I liked to party. And at the time, after the breakup, I had made gay friends for the first time in my life. And we were drinking a lot. I mean, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we were out every weekend. To me, that was partying. We never did any drugs. We never, there was never, it was never even, not even cocaine. It wasn't even offered or thought of. And so I said, sure, yeah, I do. I party. And he said, well, we're partying already. I was like, oh, okay. So in my head, this sounds so naive, but in my head, I pictured like cookout, pool party, something, something. I don't know. I just pictured something
That's
like,
fair. That's fair, right? You're
whatever.
newbie.
And it's sunny, and it's Sunday. So anyway, I showed up to a house, and he told me that his friend had left. When I was on my way, message and goes, my friend's leaving, so he gives us time. But I pulled up, and it's like the stereotypical kind of drug house. Like the yard was overgrown, and it was just this weird, it looks abandoned. And so I was like, okay. And so, but I when I got to the door and answered it, it was like this really hot guy. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm here, I'm ready to do this. So, but we went inside, and there was porn everywhere. There was a sling hanging from the ceiling, and it was a mess. And they had been a party of a group of people there for like 3 days, I guess. I had found out later. So I had come into the aftermath of that. And so he just said, do you, he just handed me the pipe because he assumed I partied. And I was like, I don't know what this is. He explained what it is. And he was like, the way he was looking at me was the way I had always wanted someone to look at me. Like I was the most delectable man on the face of the earth. Like he, wanted me so bad. Of course, now I know it was the drugs, but I was like, I'm doing this because, my boyfriend never looked at me like that. No one ever has. And so, and the way he was like touching me and stuff. So he taught me how to do it. And then we took GHB, and then, I was sped out of that 3 days later, because I, at the time I was an executive at a law school. I was teaching in the university. I was making, over six figures. And I was he we did whatever he had, and then he's like, let's buy more. And I bought more, and we went to my house, and then 3 days later we were done. And I would say that for the first time in 39 years, I felt like I could be free to be myself. I felt like I could explore my sexuality without feeling shame or internalized homophobia, or I felt like this person loved me. I felt like that he had found as what I found, and that it was just a relief that I finally belonged
Yeah.
to something and someone. So that's the story of my first time.
That's very relatable. I mean, I've, you know, we've all not, and then once you got into the scene, you realize kind of like all the signs. Yeah. I mean, just the overgrown house and the, yeah, I feel that. I feel that. So once you had your first experience, kind of where did your drug journey go from there? Like after this 3 day trip, so to speak.
So I was so excited about this because you have to kind of consider my life and the beliefs that I had and the trauma that I experienced all before that. I lived a life where I never felt accepted anywhere. And never felt like I could be my authentic self. I was closeted for all that time, 30 till I was 36. And so to me, I had finally found the answer that I had been searching for, because coming out that wasn't the answer. Coming out actually made it worse. I felt more judged. I heard more about how feminine I was in the gay community than I did in the straight community. I felt more, less like myself than ever. And so this miracle drug, this miracle elixir made me feel like I had hope. And so after that, I dove in with both feet. I couldn't get to do it fast enough. And the first guy I did it with disappeared. Of course, he went off to his whatever he was doing. He disappeared. And so I quickly found out the language, how to find it on Grindr. I quickly found out that there were guys all around me that were using that had ignored me on Grindr before, but now that I said, okay, but I have partied, and by the way, I have a house and money, so let's go. And so I started doing it immediately, like almost every day. So at first, I thought, I have my kids every other week, so I thought, well, I'm going to every other week do it. And then, take those weeks off. And that didn't last long. It started to, creep in. I would say, well, I'm just going to smoke in my bathroom, or I'm going to smoke in my room, or whatever. I'm going to do it after they go to bed, that kind of thing. I didn't last long because it became every day pretty quickly. I just couldn't get in the scene fast enough. I started to meet everyone in the city, and I started to make connections, and I started to deal, and I just went full force into it. And so that lasted about 2.5 years until I had lost everything. I had lost my job. I was trying to stay up all night, do deals and have sex and whatever up until, 5 a.m. and then go into work at 8 a.m. And I'm standing in front of these executives of a law school trying to give a marketing presentation. And, this lady, one of my friends, pulled me to the side and she goes, "What the hell are you doing?" Because nothing I was saying was making sense, But to me, I was rattling it off so fast, but it was like nothing. It was not any, it, there was no sense to it. So anyway, the job didn't last long. So I got fired, lost my car, and after that got immediately arrested for the first time. And at that point, I couldn't get a job anywhere, so I became, back to being a server. But I just kept going. I kept going until I finally tried IV. I started using IV meth, and that's when my mind spiraled. I immediately that the first time I tried it was when I contracted HIV. And so I stopped working. I couldn't function. I got involved with shoplifting. I became addicted to shoplifting because that was the way to make money. I got involved with two guys and we started hanging out together. And we would start the day at zero and try to steal enough forged checks. We were doing fraud. We were on the black web. We were doing all this shit. Oh, really seedy stuff to try to get money every day to get enough drugs because, we tried to inject 3 times a day. So basically, toward the end of my use, it wasn't even about sex anymore, and it wasn't about feeling free. It was about surviving, and all I could think about was getting the next hit and getting the next one, and in my mind thinking that money's going to come from somewhere. So I ended up getting evicted as well, and then I became just homeless. So homeless, and after I wasn't the one supplying the home anymore, my two buddies disappeared, and so here I was with a couple of bags and living by the airport under a tree. And that's when I decided I have to do something. And the only thing I had was a phone, and it did work. And that's because my mom paid for it, because she, by that time, knew that I needed a lifeline. So I called her and I was like, I'm living under a tree and I need you. So she drove from West Virginia. It's a 4-hour trip. She was there in like 5 hours, picked me up and took me back. Which I guess began my journey. West Virginia is not the place to get sober from crystal meth. And I, of course, relapsed many times after that. So that's the story of my use. Now, in the also, I guess what I left out was getting arrested more times. So I was arrested a total of 3 times for felony meth possession. I thought that I was a dealer, but I was a terrible dealer. I used it all, and then was very not careful. But at that point, when I went back to West Virginia, there was an APB out because I didn't show up for my court hearing, right? So I messed things up so much in West Virginia with my mom that she had given me a car to use to get to work. Of course, I had lost my job in West Virginia, so she took my car, and I didn't have. So I left West Virginia and came back to Charlotte and found my two buddies, and they shot me up with something, and I went even more berserk, and was walking around the streets of Charlotte, confused about where I was. I thought I was in Roanoke, Virginia, and then I lost my phone. I lost everything. So I saw a police officer, and I just walked up to him and said, I need something. Take me somewhere. Take me to jail. So they arrested me again. And so at that point, I'd been arrested 4 times. No one would answer my call at that point because everyone was done with me except my daughter. So she was 16 at the time. My son was 14. She answered my call from jail, and she said, "Of course, I'm going to come get you," even though I had done despicable things to her. And they picked me up from jail after I got released finally, and took me to a park, and I had nothing, I had nothing, and I just said, "This is it." And they said, "We need you." Like, we need you back, and because it had only been 3 years, but they need, like, we need you back. And so I started from scratch from there. I immediately, they dropped me off uptown. I went to a restaurant and got a job. Started staying on the street, and then got enough to stay in a hotel, and then worked my way up, and finally got the kids back. So we've been building our lives back together for almost 6 years now.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story. That's really inspirational. That's tough. I mean, yeah, it's crazy because like the crystal meth starts off, it's that like that light bulb situation when you use for the first time, you're like all the shit you've been carrying around since you were a little kid just goes away. And it's this it's, and you think it's just like and you're like it's such a slippery slope because then you're like then you just want it all the time and you don't even understand how far you can fall. So what are some of the like the tools that you use now to stay sober? Do you do AA? Do you do therapy? Do you do journaling or meditation? What are your tools?
So like I said, in the beginning, when I was building back my life, I got addicted to the dopamine of rebuilding. So I went into drug treatment court to hopefully to get my charges expunged, forgiven. You have to go through 18 months of very strenuous, like you get tested 3 or 4 times a week. You know what I'm saying? Rehab and probation. I had to show up to court every 2 weeks. So in the midst of all of that, I was still working two jobs. And so I would get, I got a job, and then I would get so many months sober, and then I would get a car back, and then we finally got a house to rent. And everything was just milestone, 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 milestone. And I was just on a mission, So it was about the end of drug treatment court. Everything was leveling off. Life was returning to normal. And I was standing at the kitchen sink, and it's full of dishes. Of course, my kids always left it full of dishes. And I was like, wait a minute. I was like, I just like sunk down. I was like, this is the life I had before, and this is where I was before, and now I'm bored, and I don't want this. Like, I don't want this again to just wash, rinse, repeat, go to work, wash the dishes. The reason, one of the reasons that I loved meth was not just the sex and the acceptance, but the thrill of it. It just the sketchy situations that I put myself in, and being in a hotel room at 4 a.m. to buy, and having to step over, the bodies and the people having sex. And, it was just so, it was this double life that I had was so thrilling for me. And so I just, at that point, I was like, I picked my phone up. I was like, I'm almost done with drug court. I'm going to start pinging my guys, my dealers from before. And then I was like, in this decisional period of, do I do this or do I not? And so I ran outside, and I ran into the woods. And this sounds it sounds corny, but I ran into the woods, and I'm just like looking up at the sky, and I'm like, again, I'm back to, where do I fit? What is my meaning? What is my purpose? Where am I here? And I just picked my phone up, and then I just started deleting my contacts. I started deleting the dealers. I started deleting everybody that I had knew that I could get it from. And there's something about the act of doing that that released something in me. There was this spiritual release, and I heard, I literally heard this voice saying, "We've been waiting for you." And I was like, oh. And then I said, "Well, what do I do?" And they said, "Just like this tree." I look over, and there's this decaying tree on the ground. And you're like, everything about you has to die and become something new. And so it was that point where I was like, okay, I had turned my, I grew up Pentecostal. I grew up in the church. When I came out, I adamantly refused God or Jesus or anything spiritual, But there was something about that day. It was like, oh, this is God. Like, this is spirit. This is something beyond me, or in AA and NA, they would say higher power, right? And that message, I was like, immediately had another, like, I'm immediately something clicked. And I was like, this is why I went through all of the experiences with crystal meth, is to renew, to really search inside and die to everything I knew about myself, process it, heal it, and create and transmute it into something more beautiful. Like a tree turns into flowers or mushrooms, everything, more air, whatever. And so I just started going. I was like, I'm going to research everything I can spiritual. So the first thing I did was go to Google and say, what is a chakra? And I started there, and I went forward. And so what I've used is not AA or NA. NA did not resonate with me at all. I do not identify with continuing to say I'm an addict, because I feel like I am is the most powerful statement you can make in life. And anything that follows that is you're telling the universe, bring me more of this. So if I say I am an addict, the universe is going to bring me more and more examples of being an addict. And so I didn't feel right doing that every week, and I didn't feel that I was healing or progressing. So I found a spiritual group. I found a spiritual group of people, and they were a mixture of straight and gay, mostly straight. Some were in recovery, most weren't. But there was something about being able to come into a container of non-judgment, a container of growth, a container of let's use a mirror and really look inside and see how did I get here and what can I do to heal that to change the trajectory of my life. And so just like being gay is a tiny bit of my identity, being an addict is a tiny bit of my overall identity. And I didn't have to drag that ball and chain along anymore. It is a valuable experience, but it's not, I don't identify with it. And so I use this group as my, I guess they were my meetings. I did explore plant medicine. This group also has an ayahuasca ceremony that they do a couple times a year. So I went to do ayahuasca and it blew my mind. And then I felt so like I this connection to the earth, this connection to everyone, and this development of empathy, it just helped me. The shift in my worldview was just beyond anything I had ever experienced. And so that's part of my recovery system as well. I did have some therapy. I did have some coaching, and I know the value of coaching, so that's why I became one. But other than that, I've really tried to there's a, to look at everything that I can in terms of what brought me here. What belief was it that led me to addiction? And how can I rewrite that belief and change the chemistry of my brain so that I believe the opposite. I believe that I wasn't accepted. I believe there was something fundamentally wrong with me. And finding crystal meth was me getting acceptance, right? And so if I can change that to I am perfect the way I am, and the people who are perfect for me will accept me, then my life takes a new form. So that's what I believe.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, there's there's definitely something to be said too for kind of like just like settling in and being yourself that makes it that, and the reason we start doing drugs is because we're unhappy with ourselves. And to like really push yourself into that new feeling of acceptance for your own, person is really important. I think that's one of the things I do, like I do therapy, and it's we're just trying to get me settled into really loving who I am and what I do and what I stand for. And so that's really amazing. So who is your biggest supporter? If you could call someone out and, give someone their props for helping you out, they're obviously, who's your biggest supporter?
I definitely have to say my kids. They have stood by me when they shouldn't have. And like I said, when I started rebuilding my life, it wasn't just mine. We worked together to rebuild. Of course, my mother too, but I wouldn't survive without my mom in the beginning helping me with a car and stuff like that. But definitely my kids, they took everything that I did and they saw me for who I was. They didn't dwell on the outward behaviors and the fact that, with my daughter, I overdrew her account, her checking account, by writing stupid bad checks, and different things like that. But they somehow, even as teenagers, they didn't dwell on that. They knew me for who I really was inside, and they held on, they anchored in to that knowingness and saw past it. And that they have taught me more about recovery than anyone else, and they've never had any drug problem,
That's amazing. Yeah, at 16 years old to pick up your dad from jail, I think that's so That's so strong. That's incredible. So you're now that you are sober, what are kind of some of your plans for your future? Like, what are some goals you have set for yourself?
Yeah. So, I started the sobriety coaching about 14 months ago. And my why has changed. I mean, in the beginning, I was like, I don't want to work a regular job anymore. I want to be a coach because, all this stuff you see online about working from home and remote and, blah, blah, blah. So I went into it for really the wrong reasons. And I got too hung up on the algorithms and what gets people's attention and the hooks and all that stuff. When I started to actually help men, that's when I was like, oh, like I for whatever reason, it didn't register to me that I can facilitate healing in someone else's life. And then that reverberates and the ripple effect of their families. And the families before them and after them, and their friends or coworkers. And I'm like, I'm actually making a difference here. Just for some reason, it didn't click at first because I guess it just didn't seem real. And so my plan is to grow that. And I want to offer an alternative to the 12 steps, a 12 steps that fits in with the age that we're moving into. Less about your wrongdoings and more about your shadow work, which is, accepting all of the parts of yourself and letting go of the notion that I have to let go anything about me. And also changing the way that relapse is viewed, in terms of celebrating the experience, in terms of what did it clear out for you this time? And what have you learned from it? And not this walk of shame of you have to start your days over and you have to get a new chip. And there's something about that that does not resonate with me. It resonates with lots of people and it works, but I really want to create a program where men can feel inspired, and they can really love themselves and take control of their lives and not be dependent on a group. Like, if I'm triggered by traffic and I have to say, I need a meeting right now, I've got to go because I'm triggered, that's addiction to a meeting.
Yes,
Yeah,
agree. I
that's,
agree.
yeah, yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. And broadening our thoughts. So I am not allowed to speak at any 12-step meeting because I openly talk about psilocybin and ayahuasca. I use psilocybin, I microdose, I lead ceremonies in psilocybin. I believe in it 100,000%. But to a big book, I'm not sober, right? So anyway, my goal is to continue building and providing a space for especially gay men with a history with crystal meth, because crystal meth is a different type of drug with different types of needs. Gay men have different types of needs that we're not seeing met in treatment centers, that so many therapists and clinicians don't get it. This drug has its own app, which I call Grindr the meth app. It has its own Zoom channel you can go and use with other men around the world 24/7, anytime you want from your own bedroom. This it's just it's the different it's a different need set, skill set to take care of. And so I really want to spread awareness to the general public about what's happening here. That it's what's going on around you. It's hiding in plain sight. You can get on Grindr and see parties happening anywhere you are in this country, I promise, within an hour. In most cities in the world, because I hear from them. So you're asking me what my goals are. My goal is, and that's it, is to increase awareness and to grow. And just if I can just help, not even a certain amount of people, but I get messages from random guys that I didn't even know were out there saying that reel, that video on Instagram actually helped me decide not to use tonight. And
Amazing.
that's all I need, honestly. I
Yeah.
mean, that is all that I need to know. But and I'm also as far as writing, yes, writing a book. I have a page just to get started, but it's burning inside me. It's got to come out. And so I'm writing a book too. That'll be my future
One
goal.
page at a time, right?
Right, that's right.
Yeah, I mean that's one of my things with the and again CMA and NA and AA, like all are incredible programs and incredible for people, and they really do help and they really do work. But for me, when I one of the parts of my punishment for my DUI was meetings. Like they forced you to go to meetings and get your paper signed and all that stuff. So I just sat there and I'm like, why are we beating ourselves up so hard? Everything we've done, I don't need to sit here and remember how I got sick in front of the Christmas tree, or I stole money out of my mom's purse for my go to some seedy little, like, why am I sitting here over and over this?
I know. And even that, and I would come to a group and it would be a list of how often they were triggered this week. I needed a meeting so bad today because of my boss, or whatever. I'm like, and then what did it for me was hearing a lady, it was a speaker meeting. And she had been sober for 25 years, but the trail of agony and anguish that she talked about living this disease, it, they talk about the addiction, always doing push-ups in the parking lot. It's this living in this fear, and what that is reminiscent of and correlates with is Christianity, and what man has made Christianity into. So many, that's the other thing. So many gay men have religious trauma anyway. And when you thump a big book at them, and when you have this fear that this disease, Satan, is always out to get me, then you're going to keep coming back to the meetings because you have to have them to survive. And that's the mentality of the past. That's the, that's the old time Christian type philosophy. And so that's an immediate trigger for a lot of gay men anyway. And so that the whole setup was just not resonant with me. I think for a man to come right out of a long-term meth addiction, having a place to go in the beginning, anywhere in the country, finding an NA meeting or AA meeting, doing the 90 and 90 and those kind of things, I think that's perfect. I think that gives you anchor, it gives you an alternative, it gets you out of your environment. I think that setup, I agree completely with. It's just at what point do we begin living our lives beyond it?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a really fantastic AA group here in Boston called Jaywalkers, and it's all gay guys, and it's all different, addictions, and so they've really pulled a successful group together because it is a lot of like personal time with other addict, men who are addicted to drugs and alcohol, and it's super social and super fun. They come to a lot of my events, and there's certain groups that have really hit it on the nail on the head. But the meetings I had to go to when I was forced to do it, I was like, this just feels uncomfortable. I walk in and I feel heavy. I walk in and I feel uncomfortable, and I walk in and people really are sitting there like, I have to, I addicted to the meetings. Huge thing. And I'm just like, I don't want to be uncomfortable because then I'm going to want to go like that uncomfortableness then sends my head in this little space where I'm like, I want to get rid of these dark feelings and these scared energy. So that can sometimes be like lead back to even using.
Of course. And that was the other thing too, was there were people using after the meetings, and hooking up after the meetings or whatever. What are your events you mentioned?
Oh, so I run an organization here in Boston called Sober Gay Sunday, which is a social group for gay men in
Nice.
three. So we just it's the fun part of recovery for me. It's like we just share a space together and do. We did like axe throwing. We'll do like a beach day. We do paint nights, stuff like that. So
That's nice.
yeah, it's really,
That's
really
good.
cool. So that was one of those things where I wanted to develop that group, to kind of just have fun,
Yeah.
really enjoy our lives and like do some cool stuff.
Yeah. That's a good reminder for me because I, every day in and day out, it's heavy. The
Yeah.
things that you hear and the story and even just the not even the coaching is heavy too, but people, men reach out to me all around the world and
Same.
I could use some fun.
And again, like, and people from all over the, all over the country, all over the world, see my posts and stuff like that about my events, and it's, bunch of guys in their speedos on the beach just all happen to be in, sober and in recovery, and I'm like, oh my God, I wish my town, my city, my place had this. And I was like, it's easier than you think to set up. Like, it really is. You just kind of start plugging along, and once you find one person you want to hang out with, they have a friend, then that friend has friends. And even like I refer to myself as a reformed circuit boy. So even when I go out and I go dancing, there's always someone in the club who's like, I have a sober person for you. Let me go, let me connect you guys.
That's nice.
Even in the middle of a crazy, night.
That would be healing for me too. I don't want to get off subject, but that would be healing for me too, because I still get triggered being around groups of gay men because of the experiences I had early on.
Yeah, of course.
So even you talking about that was I could feel that my stomach reacting.
Really?
Yeah, but I know that that tells me that it would be healing for me to do it.
Yeah, start
Um,
small.
but
Like, have like
yeah,
you
it's
know,
very
like,
scary though. Yeah.
and that's one
Yeah.
of the things that I mean. It's one of the things that my membership can kind of will let me know is like, this is scary. You have
Yeah.
all these gay guys in one
Yeah.
place,
Yeah.
and this is even some people like will message me and be like, I wish I could join, but things like this are the reason I started using in the first place. Like
Yeah. Yeah.
stressful social situations. Once people come, it usually is like one of those, like rip the band-aid off, and then
Yeah.
it does have an. Every single event I've ever had, people are incredibly thankful and incredibly, comfortable by the end. And it is one of those things where, I mean, I get it too. Like, I mean, I definitely, social anxiety was a part of my addiction journey for sure. And even knowing that I knew every single person at the club that night, I was still like, ooh, like, oh, but started though, because that's, he cools it right off. So yeah, I want to thank you again. This has been a great interview, and hopefully we'll hear from you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to the Sober Gay Sunday podcast. Please come back next week for the conclusion of this incredible episode. Please take a moment to like, subscribe, share, and comment. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Sober Gay Sunday. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay sober, guys.
I'm so sick of small talk, and tell me something, you're dropping at me on the head with your biggest mistakes. I don't want your daily drama, fill me in on family traumas, tell me all the medication that you take. Cause life's so short, it blinks so fast, to not say anything at all. It's wasted breath, you don't get back, so make it anything but small, small talking.